Hello and welcome to Label Sessions Presents, the podcast where we talk to the most interesting people about all the things you need to know over the next 100 days, from innovation to business design, tech and culture. I'm Fuzz Liso, and today we're joined by three brand new additions to the Label Sessions expert roster, as well as Josh Nixon from the Label Sessions team. Hello, everyone. So hello and welcome to Sarah Van Mosel, who has been shaping the business of podcasting before there was even anything to shape. From brand-funded breakthroughs to billion-dollar networks, she's turned creative chaos into structured, scalable media models that actually make money. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
And then a welcome to Lekha Bias. From launching JLo's beauty line to steering 15 brands through a supply chain meltdown, Lekha makes growth happen. She's the operations whisperer behind some of the world's biggest beauty brands, turning chaos into scale with the kind of precision that makes investors sleep easy.
Thank you.
And then hello and welcome to Roop Bhaduri. Roop doesn't just AI. He's built it, scaled it, and now teaches leaders how to wield it wisely. With experience from scrappy startup to a $5 billion transformation, he's the go-to when you need to move fast and think long-term. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
So Standard Chartered say that they think of everyone who works for them as a gig worker. OpenAI and Meta are paying, you know, big bucks to get top talent to join them full time in this remote working world where everyone joins a call from different places and all the chats in the meetings are recorded. It perhaps makes less difference what contracts people are on. How can you find the model that is right for you and your business in the sort of changing world where we're looking at, is everyone in a gig space, or are we still in a traditional model? Roop, I think this is a great one for you to kick us off.
I'm not a big fan of the word gig worker. I think people work on things that interest them. Sometimes organizations are able to bottle that and you get a loyal employee. Most times organizations cannot, and therefore then you have to try and pay them more. But ultimately what organizations are really after is people with strong internal leadership. The only way you can have remote work becoming normalized, becoming mainstream. I mean, one can argue that it's already mainstream, but you know, in terms of, you know, you have CEOs on occasion throwing a hissy fit and go, I want everyone in the office, right? Mm-hmm. And so the only point at which that will not happen is, if you're not Apple and you've not spent $1 billion on a campus, you know, anyone that is not Apple and that doesn't insist on in-person presence is if you have a workforce that has some sort of strong internal leadership core. So you're not having to police the people that you're working with. Because the moment you have to police them, that's kind of why you want them in there. Unless it's structurally important to have someone in the room, right? And that is understandable, right? If they're structurally important, you're working on a physical machine, you have to physically be on the shop floor, obviously you've got to be there. But if you're in the knowledge working economy, in the most part, there, I think having employees that are there because they want to be there, that are driven by an internal sense of purpose that is aligned with the organization's purpose. And that speaks partly to the community angle that we spoke about earlier, because community is not just external, it's internal as well. You need to have fans of what you're doing internally in your workforce so that they can develop the fans of where you're selling. So if those things are misaligned, the world's best marketing campaign can't conjure up a community, for example.
No.
So that is how I look at the sort of remote work gig economy type thing. There's just one additional point that I did want to make here. You know, there's an assumption in this question that says, you know, that all chat in the meeting is recorded. I think that's a dangerous assumption to make. It's not true. All chats are not always recorded. I've been in plenty of chats where it's not recorded. And B, there has to be permission that is sought every single time, right? Here I am in very much in camp Apple, you know, rather than camp Android, if you have to pick that battle, right? Because privacy should not be assumed. That is a breach of trust. If privacy is just, you know, we're just going to take whatever you're saying and repurpose that without explicitly asking you, that's a problem, and that erodes trust. And while it may not explicitly erode trust, over time, it creates an environment of surveillance rather than an environment of transparency. So the organizational rhetoric is that this is for transparency, but employees will feel that they're being surveilled. So they cannot speak their mind, because what you say might get you fired because it was recorded. I still remember, you know, I was fortunate enough to go to Harvard Business School, and one of the key things was our sessions were not recorded. So there wasn't a recording. So you miss it, you miss it. And the big reason was that because these were senior executives. I did one of those alumni granting executive programs, and the time we spent on campus, it was very clear that you had senior vice presidents in the room. We want you to think that this is a safe space where you can share controversial things without everything being surveilled and recorded. So anyway, that's kind of what I wanted to add to this.
I think that makes so much sense in terms of, I like that idea of sort of, you know, surveillance not equaling transparency. I think that's extremely important.
And it minimizes activity at the same time.
That fear of sort of like, it's going to come back. Or if I say something now, I've sort of committed to it without actually making the commitment to it.
It's the reason why we don't send irate emails, right? If we're going to give someone a hard time, you know, in a work setting, you're going to call them or meet them in person, but not put that in an email. Mm. It's, you know, it's one of those things that you only do when you're very, very young and you don't realize it. But as you get around the traps, you realize, you know, you don't want to put that on paper. Because you want to be very clear as to what can come back to bite you and what might not. And, it's not just about protecting yourself. I mean, especially as, you know, as employees, you want to feel safe and you want to have that internal leadership.
I think we're really missing the boat in the US on the potential of what AI in particular can do to our workforce and our whole economy, honestly. Our economy and our work economy in the US is really built on a mid 20th century chassis. Still about, it's lunchtime, Joe, let's clock out and go down and get our, you know, it's, and all of a sudden you have this tool that can do something miraculous. It can give human beings a finite resource that they can't get anywhere else, and that's time, right? If we just got creative about how we're thinking about the way we use AI, instead of saying, how can we make this, you know, 59 Chevy Chrysler, you know, work a little better with this new, you know, magic dust, throw it away, like flip it. Why can't employees think about how AI can make their lives more meaningful, enjoyable? It's because we don't have universal healthcare in the United States that people are linked to one full-time job. But like, if that wasn't a factor, how many people would love the privilege to work 30% here, 20% there? I mean, we're all here, you know, being able to do consulting work because we're privileged enough to do that.
Just
why shouldn't
healthy,
that be available
Sarah?
To everybody, right?
Just stay healthy, Sam.
We'll make money. We can't do that.
You obviously, like, the conversation that's happening around the leadership tables in U.S. companies is, how can we use this technology to cut down on costs and headcount? I mean, let's just be honest, right?
Yeah.
And that is because it's reducing the amount of people that you'll need to do the work that can be done easily through this lovely technology. That's a very ownership-oriented orientation toward this technology, right? You can, like, why we have this amazing opportunity to not keep dancing the same old dance and to not keep having the same old excuses. And it doesn't mean that revenue and capitalism and all of the great, you know, revenue-generating opportunities aren't there. If anything, they can be quickened, right? It's just we can sort of just clean the slates of how we organize ourselves around it and start to get creative about like what kinds of outputs could you have from truly motivated folks who don't have to sort of pretend that they're working for 40% of the time because that's the way it's always been done and that's how they get their health care and that's how they get their 401k. Like, yeah, that's so outdated. And there's I give ourselves as humans a lot more credit in coming up with more interesting ways of going about it, honestly.
Add to that, I think where we are today from like an AI standpoint, and I think post-COVID, like whole returning back to office culture, I do think companies really need to invest time in thinking about long-term culture and what kind of companies that they want to have. Because when we think about gig economy, obviously companies like Upwork and Fiverr have taken off for a reason. And there's a lot of people, we have seen that so many times in the news, like the software engineer, he has like a gig in India, he has a gig in San Francisco, he's doing everything while being full-time employed, right? One thing that we also need to look at, and I can speak for US and UK economy, inflation is so high, maybe not on paper, but in reality, we cannot purchase homes anymore. Food is very expensive. You can't invest in wellness outside of work because you're working all the time and you just don't have enough money. So I think when we think about structures, corporate structures, of course you have your C-suite. And then I think instead of calling it gig workers, because no matter what you do with AI, I think we're still kind of in the early stages of this technology where people are not understanding where, oh, I can go to ChatGPT, can create like an entire marketing plan for me. Well, sure, it can, but at the same time, you need an expert from a lens that can manage things horizontally. So you have your C-suite, then you have your mid-tier management, and they can manage their vertical functions under, let's say, marketing. You have five pillars, and then you manage your gig workers, whatever you want to call them. But at the same time, what kind of culture are you instilling? Is it a culture of fear? Is it a culture of like temporary employment? You know, what kind of company you want to build? Is it like, you know, you want to go through an IPO? That means you need longevity when it comes to people, when it comes to culture, when it comes to leadership, and have potential for them to grow financially. And of course, like healthcare and all those things, right? So gone are the days where people are like, I want to stay at one company. I'm going to work 30 years, get my pension in. We're just not seeing that anymore. There are still legacy companies like, you know, Unilever's of the world and P&G's and the L'Oreal's, but at the same time, that culture is shifting so fast. And I don't think anyone has sat down and thought about like, if we lose this workforce, they're going to do five gigs. We have no culture of people in place anymore. And that just creates like dishevelment. You're investing a lot in retraining and constantly rehiring. And I think that's a huge loss that we have to think about from a P&L perspective as we think about impact of AI and gig economy.